that Jews, who were considered to be God's people for centuries and for ages, now have to sit beside goyim, defiled, darkened Gentiles, and call them brother and sister the same way you might call somebody from the tribe of Levi a brother or sister. Ethnic racism runs deep in every race, not just the Jews. Whites, blacks, yellows, all of us, Europeans, Americans, Africans, Asians, we all succumb to absolutizing what is relative, our own race, and relativizing what is absolute, God's family. And the church is the only force in the world that fights it. And it's the only force in the world that can overcome it. And at every stage, the church can only do that with grave difficulty. And it always appears to be a struggle that the church is just about to lose. And you can see it moving into Acts 14 and 15. In Acts 13 and 14, we have the first missionary tour, going around getting persecuted by Jews wherever Paul goes, in every city. At first he gets a great response from the Jews, and then once the Gentiles start believing, what happens? The Jews revolt. They don't want to share the privileges. And again, they're no different than we are. They're humans the same way. We're humans. So then in Acts 15, some men came down from Judea and were teaching the brethren, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and debate among them, with them, Paul and Barnabas and some of the apostles were appointed to go up to Jerusalem, the apostles and elders, about this question. So there's a big debate, verse 5, but some believers who belonged to the party of the Pharisees rose up and said, it is necessary to circumcise them and to charge them to keep the law of Moses. How many men would convert if they had to be circumcised? I just talked to a friend yesterday who, when he was in the Navy, got circumcised when he was aboard an aircraft carrier. He and three of his friends thought, well, we got to get circumcised. There's a surgeon on board. You know, for 4 days they were in sick bay, unable to move. He described that whenever nature called, the sutures would rip because of the swollenness. He said he's never known pain that way. Well, once the word gets out, gentlemen, how many would convert? Very few. We might be catechumens for the whole lifetime, you know. But initiates, no thank you. Our sisters would be rushing in, but the brothers would be staying on the outside. Bruce Molina has a book called The New Testament World. He's a former Franciscan priest who left the priesthood, but he still does good New Testament research. Marriage is different in every culture and every age. Some cultures marry in order to actually reduce the population. And so people who marry usually leave the family. But in Egypt and throughout the ancient Near East, Bedouins marry in order to consolidate their power. How do you feel raising a woman, a sister, a daughter, for 15, 20 years, spending tens of thousands of dollars on your daughter, and all of a sudden you got to pay $5,000 to marry her off, and all that money is wasted on some other family? And her kids end up with another name, and you see them, but in two or three generations they'll forget about you, they'll be part of that family. That calls for selflessness. In the Hebrew, the word for father-in-law is literally circumciser. The word for bridegroom is literally circumcised one. In antiquity, throughout the Middle East, you got circumcised around the age of 13 when your arranged marriage was contracted. You a man? You want to have sex with my daughter? You man enough? Oh yeah, hold still and prove it. My wife was talking to Dr. Mupas right after delivering Jeremiah, and he was circumcising Jeremiah right in front of Kimberly. And it was just, ah! You know, the kid screams so loud, you know, he's like, I have not been there, but she was there for all three. Anyway, he was bragging about how in the Philippines you get circumcised at 12 or 13. He's like, you really prove your manhood. And that's the way it is throughout the world. Circumcision was practiced long before Abraham got it. Abraham got it because he slept and had sex with an Egyptian. And God waited until 13 years after Hagar the Egyptian bore Abraham a son. Because Ishmael was 13 years old, and that was the age at which Egyptians circumcised. So God said, you're going to act like an Egyptian, Abraham, by sleeping with an Egyptian. You're going to feel like an Egyptian at 99 years old. Ouch. Circumcision is a power ploy. Circumcision is a way in which When a man wants to marry your daughter, in these Bedouin cultures, you say, I'm going to be your circumciser. You're going to be the bridegroom, the circumcised one. Back then, if you married a woman, you were absorbed into her family. That way, the patriarch, who had several wives, would arrange marriage strategically to consolidate his cultural power. This is still being done in Africa and among Arabs today. Wherever you have polygamy, it's the norm. Where the father, the patriarch, tries to absorb the son-in-law into his family power and wealth, rather than pouring all that money out for nothing. Circumcision is part of something more than just religious symbolism. It's part of a socio-economic, cultural institution. It's a political and sociological tool. The more you can consolidate your culture through gaining women, remember Pharaoh back in Egypt. Why did Pharaoh want to slay all of the Hebrew males? Why did he not just slay all the Hebrew females as well as the males? Why did the Pharaoh decree just to kill the Hebrew males? Because the Jews owned Goshen, the best land in Egypt. And if you have this policy in place for 20, 30, 40 years, what will happen when you have lots of Hebrew females but no Hebrew males? Who are the females going to have to marry? Egyptians. Then who will now possess the title to all that real estate? The Egyptians. The Egyptians recognize that the Jews marry different. If we marry them, they try to absorb us into their culture. They didn't like that. If you want to study anthropology, you can get into this ritual studies. I mean, it's becoming a separate branch, a separate academic discipline. Circumcision is just the tip of the iceberg. The Jews recognized that circumcision was your badge by which you entered into the whole socioeconomic world of Judaism. Are Jews known for poverty today? 2,000 years after the diaspora, Jews are still economically and politically powerful. Israel gets more foreign aid from American government than all the other nations that receive foreign aid put together. $4 billion a year we give to Israel. That's more than all the other recipients put together. Why? It's called the Israeli lobby. They've never been known for weakness and powerlessness. That's why Gentiles like Hitler resent them so much, and they can incur hatred among Germans. In the hyperinflation of 1920 to 22, the Jews saw the runaway inflation, so they began buying up property in every major German city. Why? Because you know you're going to end up paying off the property in debased, devalued currency. 5,000 Deutschmarks today will be the equivalent of 50 million Deutschmarks in a month or two, but I'll be paying it 5,000. So after the hyperinflation in the mid-20s, the Jews owned most of the cities in Germany. And the Jews had exemptions from the German military draft in World War I. You talk about an ideal environment to stir up anti-Jewish hatred. You had it then. They misused their power and advantages. The same thing is going on here. Circumcision is an entrance rite into a socio-economic cultural institution that is wealthy, powerful, and worldwide. The great rabbinic library in Alexandria was one of the ancient wonders of the world. The Jews had clout in cities all across the empire, and wealth as well. And many people wanted to tap into it. Some people believe that Nero actually burned part of Rome to blame it on the Christians in order to get Jewish financing to rebuild it in his own honor, which he did. Is this anti-Semitism? Don't let it become anti-Semitism for a moment. If you hate your firstborn, you hate your family. If you see needs in your firstborn, look at yourself and see the same needs as well. Righteousness is exemplified in the Jews, like Mary and the apostles and Jesus and others as well. But when the best goes bad, it becomes the worst. And so all Gentiles should recognize that the Jews aren't worse than we are. They're not in a different boat. They're not more sinful. And the Jews aren't right in thinking that they're in a different boat. They're in the same boat as we are, but they're in the front of the boat. They, in a sense, influence a great deal in history. Should we resent it? No. Way. We should love them. We should share our faith with them because it's a family faith that is meant to include Gentiles as well as Jews. Is that going to be easy? No way. It's never going to be easy to confront a culture that has a great deal of ethnic pride and say to them that really God's purpose for you is to be assimilated into a worldwide family where you're going to have to call blacks and yellows brother and sister. It will always be hard for people who absolutized the relative virtue of patriotism. So here, we got about 30 seconds beyond that we're going to take here. Peter stands up and he dispenses, in one paragraph, he dispenses all Christians from circumcision and everything else. What does he say? Peter rose and said to them, "Brethren, you know that in the early days God made choice among you that by my mouth the Gentiles should hear the word of the gospel and believe. And God, who knows the heart, bore witness to them, giving them the Holy Spirit just as he did to us. What has made us holy has made them holy. We're all equal now. And he made no distinction between us and them, but cleansed their hearts by faith." When he says he cleansed their heart by faith, he's combining two images: circumcising the heart and cleansing of baptism. Baptism is the way in which our hearts are circumcised. We get new hearts in baptism, and our hearts are cleansed and circumcised through baptism. Colossians 2 will make this same point. "Now, therefore, why do we make trial of God?" Which means putting God to the test, which is a serious sin which the generation did back in the wilderness in Moses' day. "Why do we put God to the test? By putting a yoke upon the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we have been able to bear. But we believe that we shall be saved through the grace of the Lord Jesus, just as they will." What is that yoke? It is the law given after the golden calf. Listen to this. This is written now by Marcel Simon, a Jewish scholar. It's an article called "The Ancient Church and Rabbinical Tradition." By deuterosis, the early church does not mean the oral tradition, but part of the Mosaic law itself. In the early church, in this document, the Didascalia, an interesting distinction between two successive covenant codes is made. Only the first one really deserves the name of law, as expressing God's authentic and immutable will. Its commandments were summarized in the Decalogue. They are simple, true, and mild, and are to be kept also by the Christians, since they are of an essentially ethical character. Insofar as this first law included any rituals, they were not compulsory, but discretionary. The second codification was promulgated after the Israelites had worshipped the golden calf, and it is a punishment for that sin of theirs. It consists of the ritual and ceremonial legislation summarized in what is sometimes called the cultic legislation, developed at great length in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. This part of the Mosaic legislation, though indeed of divine origin, was imposed upon the Jews as a burden and intended for them only. As the Didascalia says, "God justly laid upon them the bonds as they deserved. God enforced it upon the Jews almost against his will. It certainly was no part of his own original plan. The Lord..." Now he quotes from the ancient document, the Didascalia Apostolorum, which is a document circulated in the 3rd century church, but which purports to be an explanation of Acts 15 and the decree that the church made in Acts 15. "The Lord was angry," this is quoting the Didascalia, "and in his hot anger he bound Israel with a second legislation and laid heavy burdens on them and a hard yoke upon their neck. It does not in the least concern the Christians, for in the gospel Jesus renewed and fulfilled and affirmed the law, but the second legislation he did away and abolished. For indeed it was for this purpose that he came in the first place, that he might affirm the law and abolish the deuterosis," is the word there, "for the second legislation, the deuterosis." In other words, the apostles did not dispense the Christians from certain laws arbitrarily. There was an underlying historical principle in Scripture itself that made some laws temporary and self-retiring and other laws permanent and transcending all cultures, transcultural. The Ten Commandments are transculturally binding upon all in all centuries. The deuterosis consists of all of the laws, the cultic ceremonial laws that were given to Israel because of their sinfulness. And it goes on, I won't read much more, but it agrees with the rabbis. Simon admits that this agrees with the rabbis in finding the revelation on Mount Sinai, the roots of Jewish tradition. They are to be found in the second legislation subsequent to the episode of the golden calf, of which the Mishnah and the Talmud, concerned with ritual regulations, provide the explanation and represents the development. In other words, today, Judaism is practiced apart from priests, sacrifices, and the temple. How? The Mishnah and the Talmud are the documents of contemporary Judaism, post-temple Judaism. The Mishnah and the Talmud absolutize the relative laws that were given after the golden calf. In the synagogue today, the Ten Commandments aren't even read. in reaction to the Christians absolutizing the Ten Commandments and dispensing believers from all of the other laws. All of the other laws are read, but the Decalogue from the first century, late in the first century on, was omitted from the lectionary in the synagogue. Why? In reaction to the Christians absolutizing it. This is something that I don't run into. I'll talk to hundreds of New Testament scholars, but nobody is aware of what the early church fathers took for granted. The rabbis shared it in common. Maimonides, the medieval rabbi, St. Thomas Aquinas, Bonaventure, Nicholas of Lyra, the Franciscan exegete, even Martin Luther took this stuff for granted. And yet in this century, people are completely oblivious to it. Because whenever we read the Pentateuch, the Law of Moses, we chop up the various legal traditions in the J, E, D, and P, rather than seeing that some laws were given before the golden calf and other laws were given as a result of the golden calf and the sin of Israel. This is what makes Acts 15 so controversial. Today, Jews and Christians are dialoguing, and many Christians are telling Jews, like Cardinal Lustiger, a Jewish convert who's the Archbishop of Paris, says to Jews, you don't need to convert. I only converted because God called me to. But Jews do not need to convert. Father Eugene Fisher is the Secretariat of the U.S. Commission on Jewish-Christian Relations for the NCCB, the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. Fisher argues that when Jews refuse to convert to Christianity, they're bearing heroic and faithful witness to the covenant of their fathers, and they're to be seen as righteous martyrs. Jews should not convert, according to Father Fisher, who is the secretariat of this commission. And he's in print castigating Catholics for calling Jews to become Catholic Christians. You live in a bubble here. You don't know what's going on. I'm not saying that if you go to an average parish, you're going to run into all of this. But you can't live a whole lifetime here and not run into this kind of confusion somewhere. I read this thing by Fisher. I got a letter from my brother-in-law the next week. He's a campus minister out of Penn State. He's a Baptist. He said, if becoming a Catholic means accepting this, then you've committed apostasy, Scott. I called him back and said, I photocopied that article a week before you sent it to me, Bill. I shared it with my classes to make sure that they understood all of the falsehoods that Fisher was propagating. And we laughed about it. He said, oh, good, am I glad to hear that. He said, I thought you had to believe that. I thought that was coming down from the magisterium. And I said, Bill, many Catholics think that too. Because it's stamped with the NCCB's approval, because the head of their commission is the one writing it. What we're studying right now has a great contemporary relevance. I hope you read the epistles and Hebrews with that in mind. We're out of time.